Welcome back to the Nutanix Community Podcast. I'm Angelo, and in today's episode, Dwayne chats with James Davis and Raymond Dassault from Chasm. It's a wide-ranging discussion, but specifically they discuss browser isolation and protecting your devices. And somehow the term VCR even made it into this episode. If you don't know what a VCR is, check out the show notes. Now let's join the conversation.
This week on the podcast, we have my longtime friend, so long ago that it's been a while, but we also have a new friend. So I'd like to welcome Ray Dassault and James Davis from Chasm. Welcome, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Yeah. I think a LinkedIn post or a message kind of spurred this event on. What had wanted me to investigate further into Chasm, to be honest, was around the security angle. As a Nutanix employee, our Prism management is in a browser, you know, for the most part. Yep. And it seems like the keys to the castle are in the browser from a security perspective. It used to be back in the day that you would have, a jump host in a dedicated data center and you'd have to use that thing. But man, if people are still doing that, that's great. But from what I see at customers, no, they're launching it from their desktop and, you know, all of the other bad things that happen. So maybe I'll leave it at that. And then maybe just you guys do a quick intro to yourselves and then we'll kind of dive in. You can kick it off, James.
All right. So, I'm the Chief Product Officer for Chasm Technologies. Everybody knows me as the one. I've been here for a long time. Started out in Citrix, got all the way through VMware and virtualization, and got really deep into security around advanced computer security and some of those characteristics, and started really going after this type of platform that was built around just the browser itself, because the browser workload, I mean, I remember from doing desktop analysis in 2002, right? First one on the list, Internet Explorer browser. Then the rest of the apps that came in. It's always the browser that's been the top application of the enterprise. So that's how I got here.
Now, Ray, I think most people probably know you as the thin app guy from Briarform and VMware years gone by, but there's more to Ray than ThinApp.
Yeah, I generally refer to myself as like an application monkey. I'm a grandfathered Softricity, SoftGrid AppV trainer, then acquired by VMware overnight, turned into a ThinStall guru, then a ThinApp guru, left. Then I went to Liquidware, FlexApp, product marketing manager, director of alliances, met James at VMware. Built a kinship, stayed friends over the years, did a couple of other silly things, ended up bumping into James again. And I'm excited to be fake out of EUC and working with Chasm as the senior director of alliances and ultimately helping him. You know, we jokingly say that it's 70-30, so he's 70% of everything and I'm 30% where the apps fall in. So it's we've got most things covered. So I'm excited to be here.
Now, like the company itself was kind of born in the DoD space. What was kind of the initial surge to get Chasm where it is today?
Well, give a little founder story first, because I think that it was important to figure out where it came from. One of our founders that helped design the actual platform was watching, you know, back in the day when he is a cyber offensive engineer, when he saw a lot of the hackers who were doing podcasts and so forth and explaining how they hack things, but they were doing it from their laptop. He was like, why would you ever do that? You can always trace back exactly where you're at and show that piece. He says, you need to really come up with a way that it's not actually from the endpoint, that it's not ingressing. It doesn't originate from that same endpoint, and keep it in a containerized nature. Well, they wrote a paper about that and actually got picked up by the Department of Defense, and Google, Harvard, a couple of different universities all pitched in together to help build this platform. It's actually called Project Maven. So Project Maven, when it was created, was specifically set to be a forward-thinking platform for the cyber warfare and things that we were dealing with at that point in time, where I want to be able to have things that I can make sure that don't come out. You know, things that can, you know, be shared with, you know, nation states that are our friends today that may not be our friends tomorrow, and make sure that we're keeping the information in a secured and safe place without it having to be scattered about everywhere, but still be able to give everybody ubiquitous access to it, because, you know, a browser is pretty ubiquitous in its nature. So that's kind of how we all got started out of the Department of Defense. And then roughly around 2020, they started coming out in the more commercial, because we, in 2017, we'd been all military. So you have a lot of the different military forces who automatically use us, a lot of coalition forces that currently still use us. And moving it out into the commercial space, we found that it was primarily around a mission critical applications, just where people would actually leverage and use us, because they have the same tenants, like, hey, I need it so that if something goes down, I can't walk up to it and tell me, I need to update. No, they can't have that. It has to be ready to go immediately right then at that point in time. And that's really where a lot of our initial commercial areas started really taking off at, for a lot of customers that are in play.
Really great when you're in the airport and you see like a window screen air out in front, or the update starting to kick off. You feel real, real confident about your life situation at right. that point.
And you would go to an ATM if you had to update your ATM, like, yeah, put in your card. Wait, you got to do this now.
Yep.
These stories are funny because they're true and they exist everywhere. And the enterprise isn't any different. Right. Like, there's still older versions of OS. That's why Azure has their hybrid cloud benefits to kind of like limp people along forever. But in terms of the technology and, like, you know, how you do it, like, how are you protecting, you know, the browser is just one application, but it's an important one. How are you protecting the browser?
Absolutely. You know, there's a big conversation to be had on the way that you deploy a browser to an enterprise today, right? So there are those categories of enterprise browsers that have come out, but in turn, they're primarily a Chromium browser or a Chromium derivative that they can modify or make a change to. But in essence, it's still a browser itself. And what we've did, and the technology that we've really put together, is we've taken that browser and actually moved it into a container. Now, it's a full stack OS that's in that container, but it's in an immutable state, so it's read-only. And so now the browser can be as pure, if you will, as it was on the day it was installed. And as you're still using it in a consistent basis, the container is ephemeral. Right. So during my session, when I connect to it, I'm actually using the browser. I can see everything within the container, do everything that I need to. But as soon as I'm done with that session, the container is destroyed. So there's no residual surface attack area. There's nothing that was installed there because it was a read only anyhow. So it's in a situation that puts it that way. But when you start looking at the primary changes that also are important, is that because we use a browser, allows us to really act like old school TV versus cable TV. Like, I like to make this comparison that today, when you have a client and you're looking at a presentation protocol that goes back to a data center that translates to a virtual desktop agent, like, that's a one line directly to that data center consistently all the time. And that's why at the client end, my posture, I need to check that to make sure that they can't be, you know, undone, because it's going to come directly in via that direction. We work entirely differently. And the fact that the container is more like over-the-air TV, because the container is in the data center, but it only remotely sends you the actual viewing of what's in the container to your browser. Why is that important? It's because the browser itself doesn't compute anything at the endpoint. And that's where you see a lot of the malvertisements, the ransoms, the bad, what do you call it, the plugins those all exist in that browser, but they can't be affected because we're just rendering to them that actual image of what's happening. So if you had a browser that scrapes the screen, can't see our screen. If you had a plugin that basically had a way to write what's happening on that piece, take screenshots as an example, we would have the ability to watermark that particular scenario. So you're going to get a screenshot of the watermark that you're actually seeing off that piece. So that gives us a lot of capabilities to put a DLP or a data link loss prevention or data leak prevention scenario between your endpoint and the container that's actually being spun up in the data center.
I think just to add to that is, and this might have been what you clued in on or zoned in on our first conversation, was the fact that people forget that the browser's a big deal in a lot of platforms. The minute people switched from a FAT client installed on some desktop to access infrastructure like a vSphere or like a Prism, then they switched to an HTML5, but no one ever thought to do anything with the browser itself. They just said, okay, we'll secure the data center, we'll secure the network, we'll secure everything internally. But to me, the analogy is it's almost like you secure the back door, you fix the roof, you fix all this other stuff, but the front door is wide open, unfortunately. And that's what's starting to come to bear now. And I'm going to use the word excited, but I'm cautiously saying excited. It's definitely something that needs to get fixed, and we're excited to fix it and help customers fix it. So,
yeah. So like taking a step back, you have some type of application page, broker, whatever you want to call it. You have a way of providing a browser, browsers, multiple browsers, apps.
Yeah, absolutely.
And where does that back end? Is that a service you're providing, or is it in the cloud? Is it a private data center?
Great question. So there's two aspects, again, to your point. You come in through our front end, and that front end can be IDP, SAML, LDAP, token, whatever you want to have in the front of that could be federated as well. You then click on one of those particular tiles that we present you. That tile is going to send a message back to the data center to actually spin up the actual container. Now, to your point of, is it a product or a service? We actually have both. It is a product. Chasm Workspaces itself is a product that gets installed on-prem, local, on a Nutanix environment. You can push it directly in that nature, or it's actually a service in which it can actually be installed on any cloud that we currently have, support Azure, Google, AWS, Oracle, all of those scenarios. We actually do open metal for OpenStack type scenarios as well. So wherever, and those can all be integrated all at once as well. So I could have one piece on prem, one in Azure, and one in AWS, and it all still fits underneath one platform as far as we're concerned. And it would actually be able to, you know, spin up that particular container in that particular cloud environment that you so deem by that push of a button.
It feels like Nutanix is the only hypervisor that exists right now. Is that a fair statement, James? I'm not.
That seems to be a fair statement.
I blacked out for a second. I thought that was the thing.
They've pretty much, Microsoft's pretty much killed Hyper-V, but they still use it internally. But they get to control it themselves, just like how basically Nutanix, right? We control the hypervisor because it's more curated with the hardware. I think the problem with Hyper-V always was like it just had this huge networking stack that was complicated. So like just users upon users shooting themselves in the foot. And then on the other side, the other major player, Broadcom, killed the hypervisor. But right. And I say that jokingly as a former V expert, like VMware, the product, right? We have, I don't know what the percentage is anymore, but we have a huge chunk of Nutanix customers on vSphere, but when you see a news article come out that you're going to almost double your profits and keep the same customer base, it definitely leads into a scenario where, or the sky's the limit and you find the answer and how to navigate through, you know, this business challenge. And it is a business challenge. And, you know, brokers have been kind of separated on the VMware camp. We have obviously we're a huge Citrix environment with HV today, but a lot of those Citrix environments are sitting on vSphere. And right. So like even those environments are going to have to really look at what they're going to do unless they're going to pay the money, you know?
Well, I think you're highlighting, I want to say two real key points. The first point is that, you know, when we originally started with Citrix and VMware, and again, I've been doing this for a while, I used to love the way that we came about it, which was the access strategy, right? It was an access strategy. I could walk up to you in any industry that you're in and say, hey, what's your access strategy? And you're going to go like, wait, I don't know. What should be our access strategy? How are people getting in? Right. And that is no longer the key anymore. It's also now about the security. How are you keeping your data secure? How are you keeping the people? How do I keep people out, like least privilege type scenarios? So it's been a change of the results and ends of what they need at the end user to what they need at the business layer. So that business constraint, that utilization constraint, and that technical constraints have all switched for this particular year as they're starting to move forward on what they're wanting to get accomplished. So, you know, to your point, yeah, man, the VMware, that is been a key. It is going to hurt, but people have to make some choices right now between, you know, the end of April and the beginning of September. They're going to have to make some choices on, am I going to stay on that same virtual desktop platform? Am I going to have to be able to choose? Maybe my workloads have changed. Maybe I should change that part as well as I'm switching out the baby with the bathwater, if you will. But I can't stay on if I decide that, yeah, I got to change one of those pieces. If I'm, you know, Horizon previous and I had KKR is now the owner of that software, like I don't know what they're going to do with it. So I've got to make a choice there. That'd be immediate. Now, whether or not I keep it on the same hypervisor, that's another choice that I could make, right? But it's a costly choice. I mean, imagine if I told you, like, you know, your car, yeah, I'm going to charge you, you know, two times the amount for your car this next year. You'd be like, hey, that's just not going to work out. Yeah. Well, we have four cars or four tires now. You know?
I kind of feel that's already happening in Canada. April 1st, our carbon tax goes up 23%.
That's a whole different story. But yeah, you guys are dealing with that. But yeah, it's the old versus the new. And as I'm trying to go to the new, there are so many things that I don't have to do anymore. But you know, the thing that I'm going to highlight here is the power curve of rationalized compute, right? And what I mean by that specifically is, how much does it cost to get a VCR today? Right? Yeah. 5 cents, somebody's going to hand it to you. Like,
I'm sorry. I thought you just said VCR. Like, yeah,
Well, you remember back when I was a kid, you know, I saw the first VCRs. I saw the battle of beta versus VHS, right? You know,
if you have anyone under 25 listening to this,
right?
We'll leave a VCR is in the show notes.
Right.
Because it's
HD DVD.
Right. It's because of the power curves, that rationalized thing that, you know, it's just the technology has just become so pervasive. It should be like 5 cents. That's never happened to virtual desktops, right? It's never happened in the EUC space that there actually is a power curve that it actually starts costing less the more I implement this particular technology, right? I mean, COVID should have been the answer to that conversation. It should have cost less because the amount of implementations or amount of remote access went way up relative to the cost that actually went up as well. Right. This is where that change has to happen, that rationalized computing, because every time I increase my security budget, I'm reducing the profits I'm making from my customers. And that can only go so far. Right.
Yeah.
For me, it was always the moment where there's an insanity line when you're pitching something to a customer. And I remember, I won't name the customer and I won't name the VMware sales rep, but it was basically, yeah, it's going to cost you about $1,500 per user per desktop, and you know, we're excited for that. And the customer just went, "Wait, so my Lenovo laptop is $800? Why would I?" And he's like, "Well, because of this is shiny and this and that, blah." And it just, and that became the norm. So what I'm excited about, what James is talking about, is that, hey, maybe there's actually a way to make this line go down and be cost effective. It's crazy.
I think the now I'm sure you have your own, you know, ways to do that. Like there's always a skew, yada yada. But I think that at least on the security side, that made me see some of the writing is that when you're dealing with highly secure environments, banks, in your case, Department of Defense, you take a traditional virtual desktop, that thing's got 8 agents in it, you know, like, and that might be on the small end. And the, right. Like they're trying to, I'll steal your phrase, you know, hope isn't a solution in that regard. Like so what do you do? And that alone, if you can cut that off, regardless of like hypervisors, just dealing with that problem, the increased density, there's a chance, right, that it could be for everybody.
Yeah, 100% to your point, like that compute that's happening there at that end, let's just say, wouldn't you be upset if you bought that actually has that layer of software that is now being attacked? That's if you have it, that was terrible. So reducing your dependencies on the endpoints, that is the absolute key to reducing both carbon, the operational controls and cost. A lot of those things are all set. If you could reduce that cost at the endpoint, that's exactly what we're after. Is that we don't want you to have a client at the endpoint. We just want you to have a browser. And if that browser, we should be able to give you a portal into your Windows, your Linux, your Mac, your any of the particular things you're looking for. But we're going to do it in a least privileged way that's going to be able to provide you that defense in depth that you really need versus trying to be reactive by putting a whole bunch of clients on and hoping that it catches that 0 day, which it won't, right?
We were on a call with a CISO the other day, and I guess I was shocked that all she kept saying is, it's so hard to do my job because all I'm doing is react to all of these daily onslaughts of, and James and I just kept looking at each other like, well, why, how is it this person is only reactive? Why can't we just flip the script and actually protect and close the front door? So that is, anyways, it's the whole dynamic is, yeah, just.
I'll say in fairness, I think part of the problem too is that large enterprises, their regulatory compliance part of it, have old archaic rules as well that they need to follow, which then gets them down this mess of like conforming to this thing that's probably not really helping them. You know, it's checking a box, but it's not actually helping the problem.
I mean, regulation is such a key in that conversation. There is a lot of people who are doing the thing that they think they have to do because it's fitting within regulations, right? Like they're auditing X or they're pushing forward Y because they think they have to do it. We have that situation oftentimes with a virtual desktop, right? Is that they'll put a virus scanner on the virtual desktop instead of, you know, on the endpoint, because the virtual desktop is where it's actually, you know, they're actually computing it and so forth in that nature. Well, that's additional compute and additional performance that's happening at that virtual desktop and on the endpoint, and operationally now managing two different aspects around it. There's a lot that they're doing because they're trying to stay within those standards, right? There should be a different standard for a virtualized environment versus a physical environment. And in that standard, the ability of audit trails and logging and videoing of the particular environment. That's actually what we built into our platform specifically, is that you have all those audit trails with each of the sessions that you actually control, regardless of where you're at.
Now, we've kind of talked at the, you know, saving money within a virtual desktop, kind of spreading that out into more apps, whether it's the browser or providing a brand new desktop. And then, you know, we talked about hypervisor, the freedom to pick, I guess, essentially what your platform's allowing, kind of like we allow choice in that area. But then I think the last huge piece of the puzzle is, and deal with it on the cloud side, because depending on what cloud side you end up on, it's going to be different ebbs and flows, and that's the like Windows licensing. And there's, you know, there's no, you know, every situation is like, please contact your rep. We like, no one wants to touch it for the most part, but how can you do anything on that side of the fence?
Absolutely. I think that we have taken a radically different approach to the Windows itself, the Windows workload itself. I think that's really where it starts at. The fact that we create a containered way to access that Windows workload so that it is, of course, it is off of bots. It's not, think of it as an air gap between that and the Windows environment specifically. But we actually use orchestration and automation in our platform to spin up Windows devices the same way that we deal with containers. We actually deal with those Windows devices using Windows VMs in that same way. So as you're starting to look at some of the existing environments that are in play, I can build a cloud-based conversation where it is all about subscription, where I'm not having to deal with an RDS license because I don't have an RDS cow at my endpoint, where I don't have to deal with an RDP license because I'm actually using the RDP license of the console that I'm actually given that one license for anyhow, right? Or if I'm looking at it from a spin up and spin down, that data center license from Microsoft is a great scenario on a virtualized platform because I can spin as many Windows and instances up as I can fit on that box based against that data center license, right? So I have an ability to really change that factory and cost savings around how you're dealing with the Windows-based environment. But just ultimately, whenever we talk to somebody, they'll tell us that most of their workload that they spend most of the time in the browser. And if we're going to take your biggest workload that you're working on with both of your knowledge workers are using right now, and we're going to put it inside of a containerized browser, that in itself is going to take and reduce the overall Windows environments that you have to deal with on a consistent basis. But then it puts Windows, a lot of the legacy applications, in the right way as well, because you're creating a secured, privileged access to those Windows environments, right? So again, if you have a legacy Windows Server 2012, or you have a Windows Server 2008, which you should not have, but I'm sure no one has figured out how to pull those off, if you will. as you're connecting to those particular environments, you can create that least privileged access to it.
Yeah, man, that is usually the keys to the castle. I just remember from healthcare days, when we'd have to do renewals around it. And it's just like, you start, you know, counting every license, just figuring out what you're going to do with the leftover budget, which, you know, might take the team out for lunch type of a thing. Exactly.
You know, the best part is that, you know, you can see it right now. There's how many people do you know are still writing Windows applications? Right? They're all writing SaaS-based applications. They're all really moving towards that SaaS-based front end. And that's, you know, ultimately where we wanted to go in the end. So the legacy applications that you're dealing with at that perspective are the harder applications, but we do the best in the fact that there is no VDA that needs to go on that Windows device. Right. So you don't have to keep updating that every day or every Tuesday or have to worry about the back end of that when it spins up. You could use hot patching on those environments so that you can maintain the same the day two capabilities that we support for the containers today. So that it becomes a really, really smart environment and it's containerized in a reduced risk surface altogether.
On the desktop side, what I find interesting, like the year was going to be the year of the VDI. It was also going to be the year of the Linux desktop. And I think Microsoft themselves have done a great push for their software. Like you can run SQL on Linux now. And so what are you guys seeing in the field for uptake around Linux based desktops?
So we actually see, you know, and again, I'll let Ray throw in on some of this piece, because what we see typically is that people have this initial fear, right, of Linux. Linux has initial fear of, I don't know how to make this work this way or how to make it work that way. What we have found that is when we put people in our environment, they'll come for Windows as an example. Like I want 30 Windows desktops, which is great. We'll show you how that works. We'll spin that up, you know, get that going. But then they realize, like, and I only need, you know, Zoom or Teams, and I only need, based on the Salesforce app, these two things. Matter of fact, I only really got two Windows apps that I use altogether. And when we can get them into that state of mind, or when they look at what they're doing, that's when we see them really take on the idea that they could just use this workspace that we provide. So we provide a workspace that you can use any from a developer standpoint. They all love the workspaces, so we don't have to really push hard on the developers, because the developers are using Linux today right now. It was all about having the dual screens and things like that available to them to make it more adoptable from that perspective, which is great from our point of view. But it was really the Windows people who would be more afraid of this particular thing until you presented them with a GUI front end that looked like a Windows base, meaning that it was nice and shiny. It had rounded edges as far as the icons that were going. We had many people adopt into that. We have right now, again, one of the conversations that we have that I really, really love is one of our customers that's in Finland. His name's Nico. I'm sure if you guys get out there, you'll see Nico. He posts all the time. He did a great job because Finland themselves had a whole initiative to be able to move off of a Windows-based platform into a Google Chrome-based platform, as an example of this conversation. And so they took on workspaces and they took on a couple other things, but their Windows environments that they tried to move over to the Chrome, but they couldn't do, right? And so they had a couple of different issues that were going back and forth. They tried a different couple of softwares until they landed on us. And what we presented to them was the ability to not only take that to that next layer, being of the browser, but then also take some of those existing Windows applications and turn them into Wine applications, so that then they were able to just deploy them via the containers themselves as well. So they were able to take away some of the older ones that are legacy applications that you can't use anyhow, just bottle them up in Wine and put them in the container. And now all of a sudden you're able to deploy out this environment in a consistent basis with the right security profile on it, which is being updated every single night by itself. Right. So it changes the entire mix when you started pushing it that way. So now all his people are using a full in desktop. The conversation around one of their chemistry groups that was looking at getting a Mac interface in play, because we can do the graphics and shared GPUs and so forth. He entertained them saying, like, you could just use this Chromebook instead of waiting on these Mac Airs. And that changed the whole environment that they're like, yeah, we'll just use these Mac Airs now. These Chromebooks now, because it's that easy. I'm able to get the same graphical capability, but I'm utilizing it within a Chromebook itself. So there's a big change from moving to a read-only OS, like a Linux-based derivative of either an iGel, StratoDesk, or a Chromebook, right? Those are all great Linux derivatives that you can get into and that are functional. And matter of fact, all our kids are already using Chromebooks, right? So they're very efficient on actually using a Linux desktop.
Regardless of vendor, like in my perspective, and I haven't been in the weeds like in VDI for a long time, but my perspective looking in, there hasn't been like drastic changes to the stack. Like it's still dealing with, it's the kind of the things in a VDI environment that'll kill you is the need for GPUs and printers. You know, it's like those are kind of like will decide you down a path. But it's kind of the enable, like everything's being commoditized, right? And that the desktop is just another one.
It's always been little whispers, like, and I won't name names, but it's like I it's like, well, we want to get rid of Active Directory. And you're like, whoa, like, what are you saying? And then it's like, oh, well, I don't want to use that. And I don't. So it's just a fascinating time. So from my perspective, I'm not sure if it's the year of the Linux desktop, but it's not the year of the Linux desktop. Like it definitely there's some movement around.
Yeah, I would label it as this year in the industry, what you're going to see is the year of financial sense.
Yeah.
Kind of spin up, but I think it's everywhere. People are going to have to relook at how they're operating and justify the path forward.
Yeah. It's almost like you can't have both. It's almost like you can either, if you want to save money, we're going to present you with some options, and you may not have liked them in the past, but you may like them now.
Well, I'm gonna tag along on that same point you were talking about as far as the commoditization of the actual hypervisors and so forth. I remember back in the day when we used to do bake-offs, right? You used to get brought in to do a bake-off of VMware versus Citrix, but at some point they got to parity, and that parity is exactly that same plateau that we're all sitting at, right? Because it actually hasn't gotten to that next layer, because going back to our security perspective, right? There are so many things that that environment still needs to talk to for a person to log in, from AD to additional databases to each Citrix server needing to talk to each other and so forth. So there's a lot of spread that has to happen for that type of security that needs to go into play there. And when you're dealing with that, that's the way it was originally created. That's some of the capabilities in which, again, it's a new world. It's been changed the way that it actually should be now, with a different security, different capabilities. And so some of those features are entirely different that you're looking for now versus, I want to use a roaming profile. I don't want to use a roaming profile. I would like to get a geo-distributed profile that I don't have to build all these geo-distribution points into it. So like when we built an S3 profile so that you can automatically use an object store, whether it's Azure Blob or whether it's S3 or whether it's Google Blobs, it doesn't make a difference to us. But guess what? All that distribution should go there versus anywhere else in that particular spot.
I think my last thoughts on, before we part ways, is that the especially around the hypervisor and commodity, is that the story around Nutanix, has always been the integration. Like, kind of like we solve storage, but the hypervisor allowed us to do other things, networking, but also security, like our automated STIGs. You can run them and, hand that off to very stringent levels and be in a great posture. And then, if I'm following the whole Chasm story, security, desktop, browser, I think there's something there. I know officially, it's early days, but there's no partnership per se, but it'll run on AHV, right?
So great point. So it runs on AHV. You can use it for the pooling capability all day long. So you get the same spread, you get the same spin up, you'll get the same efficiencies of the reduction of not having to just be into a full Windows desktop, but instead just into a container browser. So you get the efficiencies both from compute and cost saving and so forth on the AHV hypervisor. But to your point, I think, which is the really great point around STIG, is that most of our customers have an AOT, right? And so that authorization to operate is what that AOT is really going to be around. And that gets them into those security, high secure scenarios that they want to be within. Now, we have STIG scripts and controls inside of our environment as well. So again, you STIG our environment, you STIG your environment, and you really got a great way for any of these that have an AOT that is a FedRAMP that they need to worry through. We would be a perfect mix together.
Well, folks, if you're listening and you come this far, I would encourage you. I only learned about Chasm a week ago. I think there's something there. Check out their website. We'll leave some links behind as well. But it was a blast having both of you on, and interesting and timely, I guess, is the way I'd put it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Absolutely.
And that's a wrap for today's episode of the Nutanix Community Podcast. I hope you found the discussion on browser isolation with Chasm informative. Don't forget to check out the show notes for links to further resources and information at next.nutanix.com. Thanks for tuning in, and from your friends here at Nutanix, have a great